Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, the U.S. Defense Secretary stops off in Iraq. Japan and Ecuador are working to recover from devastating earthquakes. Global oil prices fall back more than 4%. And we'll get a preview of singer Kenny Rogers' last world tour.
It begins May 13th in Minnesota. It cuts across the U.S., and then it hits the Philippines in August. And then it goes to Scotland, the Netherlands, Ireland, and England in the fall.
It's right here on The Voice of America. U.S. Defense Secretary Ash Carter traveled to Iraq today to talk with his commanders and Iraqi leaders. Traveling with the official is Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb, and she joins us on the line. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Susan.
Say, what is the Defense Secretary hoping to accomplish with this visit to Iraq?
Well, I think he has several different things on his agenda. He wants to focus on what the Iraqis need and what the coalition needs to do to accelerate the campaign against the Islamic State. He's looking at three key areas. He's looking at what can be done economically. What do the Iraqis need to help them rebuild the areas that they've retaken from the Islamic State? He's also looking at political reforms and pushing for political development within Baghdad. And then finally, he wants to look at the military campaign itself and see what can the U.S. contribute to the Iraqis and to the coalition to make this a stronger defense against the Islamic State.
What is the United States already doing?
Well, the United States already has thousands of troops here. They've been providing trainers to help build up the Iraqi army. They've also provided a lot of ammunition and equipment. And I think that what they're going to be looking for from the Iraqis is, what more do you need from us? Is that going to be in the form of Apache helicopters, which have been offered before and not yet taken? Is that going to be in the form of more troops on the ground, more U.S. troops on the ground, be they in a training role or be they in a more advise and assist role or in some other form of protection, possibly sending them in to help with Apache helicopters? Because if there is going to be more equipment that's going to be sent in, then they will have to have U.S. personnel on the ground to help those things be executed as quickly as possible.
The fight to retake Mosul is also an important issue to the Secretary, I understand.
Yes, a senior defense official has told me that the road is all about Mosul, because Mosul is the key to defeating the Islamic State in Iraq. It's Iraq's second most populous city, and it's been a stronghold for the Islamic State since summer of 2014. So all of the things that have been going militarily are to try to help the Iraqis encircle Mosul so they can squeeze the Islamic State out of that stronghold.
The defense secretary doesn't have a carte blanche for doing everything he might want to do there in Iraq.
Well, actually, the secretary has been telling reporters on this trip that the president of the United States has been very helpful and has not denied anything that they have asked once the Iraqis ask for it. That's been the sensitivity, because more U.S. troops on the ground is going to be a very sensitive thing for the Iraqis. The Iraqis take pride in doing this fight themselves. They do not want to have a lot of Americans on the ground. President Obama does not want to have a lot of Americans on the ground either, because, as Secretary Carter has put it, this is not about U.S. troops substituting for local forces. Everything that is being done here by the United States is to enable those local forces to push the Islamic State out.
Well, do you know where the defense secretary is going next?
After this trip, the secretary is going to be heading to Saudi Arabia, where he will focus on that economic front. He is going to be talking to some of the Gulf Cooperation Council leaders, asking them to help put money into the Iraqi government so they can start rebuilding some of these areas that the Islamic State has demolished.
Well, thank you very much, Carla, for speaking with us today from Baghdad.
Absolutely.
This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Renowned physicist and cosmologist Stephen Hawking and Russian internet investor and physicist Yuri Milner recently announced an ambitious new program they hope will someday send a fleet of tiny spacecraft to the stars to explore space and search for life in the universe. Called Breakthrough Starshot, the project plans to send gram-sized nanocraft into deep space at a velocity of about one-fifth the speed of light. The tiny spacecraft would be driven by a powerful laser beam generated here on Earth. The probes would capture images and gather scientific data of possible planets in Alpha Centauri, the nearest star system, in just a little over 20 years after being launched. Considering that the Alpha Centauri star system is 4.37 light-years away from us, it would take nearly 30,000 years for today's fastest spacecraft to reach the system. The plan is to launch them to Alpha Centauri within the next generation. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
Ecuador and Japan are engaged in rescue and relief operations following strong and devastating earthquakes. Ecuador suffered a 7.8 magnitude quake Saturday along its Pacific coast that left more than 270 people dead and hundreds more injured. Japan was rocked by two major quakes Thursday and Saturday, the most powerful Saturday's 7.3 magnitude quake. Both struck in the southern island of Kyushu and left at least 42 people dead and dozens injured. Tens of thousands were evacuated. Gabriela Benitez with the humanitarian agency World Vision in Quito, Ecuador's capital, told VOA's Victor Beatty she felt the quake 170 kilometers from the epicenter near the tourist city of Pedernales, the hardest hit community.
Thanks God, we have no damages here, but we have a lot of problems in the provinces, especially in Manabí province and Esmeralda province. We also, as NGO, we are coordinating all the efforts and all the response with the local authorities and also with the humanitarian team of the country.
What are the rescue efforts underway?
Right now, we are trying to satisfy the basic needs of the people, which is, for example, bottled water, also medicines, because the hospitals are full of people which are sick and which have cuts because of all the things that have been falling down because of the earthquake. We are helping the authorities to make all these distributions. We are trying to make fundraising to be able to support, because even though there are a lot of humanitarian agencies and local authorities working in the zone, in the affected zones, but as you know, these kind of events are always superior than our capacities to respond and to have a big coverage.
The area most affected is called Pedernales. It's a tourist spot with beaches and palm trees. What can you tell us about that?
Pedernales is totally destroyed. Rescuers are trying to rescue people from under the buildings, the hotels, and everything that is completely destroyed, that city.
Ecuador, of course, is in the Pacific Rim where earthquakes are prone. Is this the biggest quake that you can remember in Ecuador?
Yes, sure. It's the most biggest earthquake during the last 30 years.
Authorities have declared states of emergencies in the hardest hit provinces. Thousands of soldiers have been deployed to keep order. Several neighboring countries have sent rescue personnel and supplies. Ecuador's last major quake occurred in March 1987, leaving some 1,000 people dead. In Japan, where the two quakes were followed by hundreds of aftershocks, Asian Studies professor Jeff Kingston of Temple University in Tokyo says the Japanese are accustomed to such natural disasters.
You know, back in 2011, about a month before the major quake struck, there had been a series of volcanic eruptions down in Kyushu that lay a thick layer of ash over wide areas. And here, then a month later, there was the big quake. So, you know, I think that everybody in Japan understands that their time will come at some point. It is a country that is often whacked with horrible natural disasters, tsunami, earthquakes, volcanic eruptions. One thing that seems to be encouraging is so far that the only nuclear power plant that has been restarted is actually located just over 100 kilometers away from the epicenter. And so far, the reports are there have been no malfunctions, no problems.
Factories for major manufacturers such as Toyota and Sony and Honda were closed. Are there going to be supply chain disruptions around the country as a result?
Yes, I think that the damage to the infrastructure, landslides are blocking major roads, train service has been disrupted, there have been interruptions in water supply and electricity and gas, so that a number of companies have announced temporary closings, and early estimates are that the economic cost of this quake will certainly be well above $10 billion.
The historic Aso Shrine, more than 1,700 years old, suffered damage while part of a wall at the 400-year-old Kumamoto Castle collapsed. The U.S. military is assisting relief efforts, but Jeff Kingston says the damage to the Japanese economy will likely be minimal. In our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee tells us how the online community is reacting to the tragedy in Ecuador. Hello, G.
Hi, Susan.
The Ecuadorian president has been tweeting quite a bit. How can we find him on Twitter?
He's on Twitter at Mashi Rafael. That's M-A-S-H-I Rafael with an F. He has been updating the death toll and sharing his gratitude for the international community's support throughout Sunday.
Tell us about some of the tweets.
Sure. One of his latest tweets reads like this. Controlled public safety, preparing shelters, mobilized across the country, thanks to the whole world for solidarity. He writes only in Spanish, but Twitter lets its users to see the translation on the website.
What's the response like from U.S. presidential contenders?
There hasn't been a tweet from the three Republican contenders, but both of the Democrat contenders sent out tweets. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders tweeted, "We express our condolences and solidarity with the people of Ecuador and Japan as they recover from these devastating earthquakes." Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton also wrote, "Our hearts go out to the people of Ecuador and the families who lost loved ones from yesterday's earthquake," and signed it H. She also sent out another tweet in Spanish that means the same.
Speaking of the race to the White House, things are looking good for Republican contender Ted Cruz.
He won all 13 delegates up for grabs at the Wyoming State Convention Saturday. And also on the election front, former President Bill Clinton, husband of Hillary Clinton, said Bernie Sanders supporters want to shoot every third person on Wall Street. He was joking on camera after an event in New York last weekend. That's all for me today, Susan.
Thanks for the wrap-up, G. She tweets for our program's account, at VOA_IE, and from her own account, at G. Abby Lee. Coming up on International Edition, oil talks fail to reach consensus, and singer Kenny Rogers' last tour. Global oil prices fell back more than 4% in trading today after members of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries and non-OPEC producers failed to agree to a freeze in production at January levels during a meeting in Qatar. Global stocks also declined. Qatari Energy Minister Mohammed bin Saleh Al Saada said more time is necessary to reach consensus.
The meeting concluded that we all need time for further consultation, and from now till June meeting in OPEC, all participating countries will consult among themselves and with others.
But he said the market fundamentals are improving, citing a cutback in oil production. Iran, which did not send its energy minister to the Doha meeting, said it wants to raise output now with the nuclear agreement in place and UN sanctions eased. Saudi Arabia said it would not accept a freeze if Iran did not. Oil, which bottomed out below $30 a barrel in January from $100 a barrel in mid-2014, had been steadily rising to above $40 a barrel amid hopes of a production freeze. Houston-based market analyst Carl Larry of the consultant group Frost & Sullivan spoke with us about why Riyadh is balking at a freeze that it has indicated it wants.
There's a lot of potential coming out of Iran, whether you look at it by the oil standards, and there's going to be a lot of oil coming out of there, or by financial standards, where a lot of money wants to go to Iran, wants to pump that oil, wants to make a good investment. And that takes money away from Saudi Arabia. So a little bit of trouble there.
And what is Iran's intentions?
They want to get back to their pre-sanctioned levels. But now when you have more money invested in Iran, other countries that were once dedicated to Saudi Arabia that now have opportunity to go into Iran, it takes away some of their power. And, you know, that's a big deal here. They don't want to give up the oil, they don't want to give up the money, and they don't want to give up the power.
We asked about a call for more consultation among OPEC and non-OPEC producers.
You know, this is a big peace agreement. The issue here is that everybody has to get on the same page. And when it comes down to oil and money and power, everybody has to share. And that's always been a problem with OPEC. It's sharing the wealth. So I think everybody wants to do this. They want to see higher oil prices to make their incomes better, their economies better. But it's a matter of sharing that at the same time.
And where are oil prices heading now?
I think we're headed back lower. We'll probably see 38, maybe even 36. But we're in a good scenario right now where oil demand is higher than usual. We're heading into the summer driving season. Should keep us propped up. So we'll stay here between that 36 to 45-hour area going forward.
He says there could be a domino effect if one of these oil-producing nations fails.
This has this issue where if an economy fails, a Venezuela, a Nigeria, it could have this knock-on effect to other economies. You know, we have a lot of credit out to these Latin American countries. Venezuela is a very key cog there. If that fails, you might see other major Latin American countries go through hardships, and that will eventually come back to us. So we want to see everybody maintain, but at these levels, it's going to be hard.
Market analyst Carl Larry. This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Many of you may know Kenny Rogers from his song Lady or his duet with Dolly Parton, Islands in the Stream. His albums, The Gambler and Kenny, have been called two of the most influential in country music history. He has won numerous awards and charted more than 150 hits across various genres. In late September, Kenny Rogers announced his pending retirement from music and just released the details of his final worldwide tour. Nikki Strong of VOA Music joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to tell us what this Country Music Hall of Famer has in store.
So, Nikki, when does the tour kick off, and what does Kenny have planned for the show?
The tour is called The Gambler's Last Deal. It starts in May and goes through mid-November, but dates are still being added. They anticipate it will go into 2017. It begins May 13th in Minnesota. It cuts across the U.S., and then it hits the Philippines in August. And then it goes to Scotland, the Netherlands, Ireland, and England in the fall thus far. The show itself, he says, will be a retrospective covering his 50-plus year career. It'll include personal stories and photos and video clips. He'll be performing songs outside of his common set list. And he also said expect more of his comedy dialogues, too. And Grammy-winning country singer Linda Davis, who, by the way, is also the mother of Hillary Scott of Lady Antebellum, and Charlie Warsham will be his guest.
Well, many country artists perform well past retirement, so why has he decided to call it quits?
Well, it's still past retirement for him, but, he decided to really call it quits, primarily to spend time, more time with his twin sons, who I think are about 12 years old now. He says, I've done everything I could do. He said, I've won everything I could win, and now my life has to go on. He also recently shared that he feels that today's country music is going in another direction, and he's not interested in competing.
Well, this notion of country music moving in another direction or away from its roots is an ongoing theme in the country music discourse.
Yeah, it is. Country music has always experienced a certain amount of pop success and crossover success, but pop music is changing. And as contemporary country artists endeavor to create crossover success, they're going to borrow from what's popular. So in addition to many current artists, they've also grown up on other musical influences and in different historical times than the older artist. But overall, though, I think the music is cyclical, and eventually people will turn to their roots to receive inspiration. So I think popular country music may start to have a more traditional aesthetic in the future. And there's definitely an audience for it.
And many in that audience will most likely catch Kenny Rogers on this tour.
Most definitely.
For more information on the Gambler's Last Deal Tour, you can go to KennyRogers.com. You can also hear more traditional and contemporary country music on Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong on VOA 1. To reach Nikki, you can connect on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA underscore music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
Baby, when I met you, there was peace unknown. I set out to get you with a fine-tooth comb. I was soft inside. There was something going on. You do something to me that I can't explain. Hold me closer and I feel no pain. Every beat of my heart, we got something going on. Tender love is blind. It requires a dedication. All this love we feel needs no conversation. We ride it together, making love.
If you would like to listen to today's program again, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Africa Logistic Forum is an example of how the United States can support African nations to examine and explore continuing logistics challenges in Africa's security sector, said U.S. Ambassador to Ghana, Robert Jackson. Speaking at the opening ceremony of the Africa Logistics Forum in Accra, April 12th, the ambassador noted, "The forum focuses on analyzing the existing logistic gaps, explores practical applications, and surveys sound principles for effective logistics management." The United States, he said, continues to recognize the importance of the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. The center's mission to provide training, education, and research to foster peace and stability in Africa is vital and has impact on real lives throughout Africa. The center has already trained more than 11,000 people from diverse organizations in essential aspects of peacekeeping operations. The United States' main objective, said Ambassador Jackson, is to support African nations with all required assistance. It is imperative to have experienced personnel with the right equipment and training if we are to overcome the logistical obstacles we face in garrison, operational, or tactical environments. Our Ghanaian partners have been a major contributor to the United Nations peacekeeping operations, he said, supplying more than 3,000 personnel, including police, military observers, and troops, in the past 8 years. Exercises such as the Logistics Peacekeeping Operations and the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team, conducted in Ghana, Togo, and Benin in the last 2 years, have been essential for training logistical units and personnel. The Logistics Peacekeeping Operations is a training event focused on logistics before, during, and after peacekeeping operations. This exercise covered sustainment principles, including preventative maintenance checks and services, subsistence and field feeding, general supply, transportation, distribution, as well as logistical estimates. In addition, the African Deployment Assistance Partnership Team bridges the gap between limited deployment capacity to participating nations in peacekeeping operations, humanitarian response operations, and contingency operations. Ambassador Jackson told the forum participants that the United States and the nations of Africa share a common destiny. "I am confident," he said, "that work like yours will allow us to marshal the tools necessary to craft partnerships and, as Kofi Annan said, to face our goals together."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.